But if you go onto the website, if someone you know is dying, or you know, for yourself, if you go onto the FPMT website, become familiar with it, because it is a fantastic. No, it's worth it. It's not just for buying books. There's lots of free stuff, lots of downloadable stuff. But also there's direct links to other things. For instance, when my mother and father died, were dying, I was able to go onto the website and send requests for prayers and pujas, yeah. But following the links from the FPMT website. Okay. Yeah. And those went to His Holiness the Dalai Lama,
yeah.
It went to Rinpoche, and it went to Kopan. You know, so they've really got it sussed to make it as easy for us as possible to link to these wonderful places. So it's nice to go onto the website and play about, you know, and say, well, what do I get from it? It's not just about buying stuff. Okay. There's lots of links which are worth exploring.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Hey, I just had a question, if I might. I'm still a bit confused about the difference between attachment and pleasure. Can I just give you an example? Yesterday, when after the session we went into the dining room, someone had put flowers on the tables, collected flowers, and I thought, oh, you know, how wonderful.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
Yes.
So
wonderful.
I immediately asked myself, so is this attachment?
No. Attachment is much stronger than that. Attachment is wanting more. Attachment is me, I, mine.
Right, right.
You know, yes. Not wanting to let go. Within Tibetan Buddhism, attachment tends to be emphasized more than desire. Within the Theravadin, the word desire is used a lot as the one of the three poisons. Within the Tibetan translation of this, they use the word attachment more because it's more descriptive. Because you can have a desire to be enlightened.
Yes.
You know, you can have a desire to be compassionate. So it's a huge poison. Attachment is a poison. But enjoying the sunshine, enjoying flowers, it's clean, it's clear. This is not attachment. However, this is not gross attachment. However, what you have to understand about these things is that they're ingrained within us. Attachment, aversion.
Yeah.
They're with ignorance. These three poisons are so ingrained, we don't even know we have it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We use the word attachment as if it's gross. And it is gross, of course.
Yeah.
But it's real attachment is much more subtle than that. Much more subtle. That's why it's one of the three poisons.
Yeah.
Ignorance, attachment, and ignorance is what gives rise to attachment and aversion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more dense. But taking simple pleasure in something.
Mm-hmm.
This is no attachment. If you want to be wise about it, then you take pleasure and offer it.
That's what I was going to ask. To guard against the subtle attachment, do you offer gratitude? And
well, I would. It's not so much. It's so insidious, attachment.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even point to it. You can't even point to it. It's like ignorance. You can't point to it. It's just how we enact. We have to refine and refine and refine our minds to be able to do this. So we work on a very gross level. So anything that helps reduce attachment, you do. But you're doing it on quite a gross level. But still, that's all we can do. The more study and the more, the more vows you take, to be honest, you start to purify your mind, you start taking the 8 Mahayana precepts, you may take the 5 lay vows, whatever you decide to do. This is all purification for the mind, and it becomes more and more and more subtle. But straight away, if you just get into the habit of anything you enjoy, enjoy it to the full.
Mm.
But enjoy it on behalf of all living beings.
Right.
May all living beings enjoy this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great way to get into the habit of a compassion, love, and the highest of all, bodhicitta.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not about keeping yourself in a straitjacket. It's interesting, a lot of, I've noticed a lot of religions, they start off being quite wide and welcoming, yes?
Mm-hmm.
The more you get into it, it kind of starts to narrow a bit. This is only my own observation. I'm not saying which religion, but until you're kind of in a straitjacket,
mm-hmm.
or what you can do. Whereas many people's experience of the Dharma is it seems to start off like that. Well, I can't do this and I can't do that and I can't do that. And then the more you study, the more you learn, the more you meditate, the wider this avenue becomes. Because it is all it's to do with mind. So actually, it always seems to work the opposite, you know. Mm-hmm. When people first encounter the Buddhism, it's like, right, I have to do this, this, that, you know, and you just see them walking around, you know, not smiling, and you know, it's quite odd sometimes. Mm-hmm. Then when you study and you meditate, and you kind of let go of all that, and you start widening things out, the mind starts to relax, becomes very expansive. Mm-hmm. And the more expansive your mind is, the less you want anything. It's interesting. This attachment becomes not very tasty. And you start to realise that really the wealthiest person is the person with no attachment, with no desire. And that just widens it out.
Okay, thank you. That's
you're welcome. Help. You're welcome. Anything else?
So we say precepts. I could do this any time I wanted.
You can. It's good to do it with a fully ordained person first. That's what they say. It's like a lot of things. If you could do it, I'm fully ordained, so that's quite good. So you could do this now on your own. But I would highly recommend if you could possibly do this with someone like Geshe Tashi. Geshe-la here, before he goes away. Lama Zopa, any of the great lamas that come, their power is immense. I mean, their power is immense. If you ever get the opportunity to do it with them, it's far more powerful. Right? But yes, if you want to do it on your own, you can do it on your own.
When you say do it with them, could I, for instance, Geshe-la give me a Skype address? Could I do it over Skype with him?
I've no idea how we would do it.
What I mean is it the same as doing it in person?
I don't think it is. I mean, personally, I don't think it is. However, things are changing rapidly with IT. Things are happening now that I never thought would happen 20, 30 years ago. But there's nothing to stop you now taking the precepts. I would say that it's best to take the precepts before sunrise. We tend to do it later here. First time I did precepts about 3:30 in the morning in Nepal, and we were told to look at our hands outside in the dark. And if you could see the lines on your hands, you were too late. So, I mean, things are kind of more relaxed now, but basically it's best to do that before sunrise. And if you can, just have the one meal at lunchtime. Again, if you want to do it more correctly, have it before midday. More importantly, as you're eating, yes, and you stop, if 20 minutes has elapsed, you can't eat again. So there's all these things. If you're going to do it on your own, then you've got far more control of your environment, so you can do it to the purest way. Okay. Anything else? It's just because it's halfway through, it's good to just check in with people. Okay. So, we settle ourselves down. Relax the body. And calming the mind. When you're doing meditation, it's quite good if you can to keep the body as still as possible. Not rigid, but still. Very helpful. So this getting into the right position is important, because once you're in it, quite nice to try to gently hold that without moving. So consider this. If we become familiar with impermanence, we begin to see and we begin to expect to experience the transitory nature of all phenomena. Just consider that. Okay. Can I, though, view my death and the death of loved ones as inevitable and behave with courage and acceptance? Can I? Or do I allow fear and grief and panic to arise and take control? Can I walk and act within this reality? Or will I avoid or be glib and trite in my response and quickly move on? These are my choices. We cling to this life as if it were permanent and unchanging. This life is indeed highly precious. It's just not permanent and unchanging. If I remain aware of impermanence and death, I will be alive to the present. I will view the past, although interesting, as like a dream. And the future, although exciting, it's a fantasy. This is a kind of freedom. if I behave this way, the disparity between our intelligence and how we behave will close. My mind will become more stable. I will become content and do what is meaningful for myself and others. So for a few minutes, reflect on these points. Allow a feeling, a positive feeling, to arise. And then if you can, just rest in the clarity. Just rest in that conclusion. Just rest. Thank you. So just a little clarification. I'm just reminded myself that when I said I contacted people through the FPMT, for my mother, I was so upset. I was at the hospital and I phoned my friend Wendy, and she's the one that went through the website for me. I'm just remembering that. Because, and that's always good to have. If you've got a Dharma friend, definition of a Dharma friend, someone who doesn't think you're mad for doing what you do, right? But if you've got a Dharma friend or an organisation that you're close to, you have links with, it is so important. I mean, so helpful in this world. You're not alone. You're really not alone. You phone your Dharma friend up for help. You phone a centre and ask for advice and help. Even if you're too traumatized to do anything yourself at that moment, they've got access. They've got access to all these things. And I've never known them yet not do what you ask them to do, Konkak Kopan for you or whatever. You know, because sometimes you're dealing with, you know, a lot of stress and you can't quite do that. That makes sense. Yeah. Good, good, good. Okay. So, right. I talked earlier about how we talk about a gross body and a subtle body. Okay, a subtle body. So the gross and subtle body is extremely important at the time of death, when you understand what's going on. Teachings on the subtle body, including channels, winds and drops, are to be found mostly in tantric teachings. And so, and they go into great depth about that. But for the purposes of this course, we'll think about it like this. This subtle body that we have, not tangible, within the body, if you imagine, there's a central channel which is about like a straw, the width of a straw, but non-material, made of light. And it goes from the crown of the head right down through the body in front of the spine, not touching, but in front of the spine, past the navel, and then it branches. One part goes to the sex organs and one part goes to the back passage. Okay? And this central channel is very important. It's where you have the chakras. Okay? The other two main important ones lie to either side of this. The right channel, which is red, and the left channel, which is white. These channels start just inside the nostrils, and they follow closely the central channel. Like an umbrella coming up and round, down. I think for the purposes of this, imagine it joining the central channel, just below the forefinger width, below the navel. These are the three most important channels. The central channel is a kind of, again, this comes from Tantra. It's a kind of blue, quite a light blue. And inside is kind of oily red. And as I said, the right channel is red and the left channel is white. Now, from these, there are branches going out to all parts of the body, carrying energy winds. And the mind travels on those energy winds all through. Yeah, it's all through the body, the mind. In our present state, there are difficulties. And the difficulties are, there are knots at the chakra where the left and right kind of tangle around at certain points in the body, at these chakra points. And what that does is it blocks the movement of any energy in the central channel. Okay. Now, yogis practice hard in Tantra to release these knots, allowing the winds to come into the central channel through control. Why? Because as we are now, our energies are going in the wrong direction to start with. They're going in the wrong direction. Because they're going in the wrong direction, there's all the negativities, different type of negativities going with the mind, you see. Our mind has a lot of things added to it. So although the definition of mind is clarity and awareness, it's got other things, isn't it? It's got anger, jealousy, pain, hate. It's got all these things, right? But the good thing about these things is they're temporary. They're temporary. They're adventitious. And because they're like that, you can get rid of them. Right? But the yogis who work to getting the energies into the central channel, just by doing that, all these concepts disappear. They actually disappear. The knots loosen. And why do you want that? Because what happens is the mind becomes more and more and more refined by the winds entering the central channel. And actually they can access the highest form, which is called clear light. We'll go into that. And they can harness that clear light and stay there. Why would they want to? Because the mind that's going to be there is a mind free of these dualistic concepts. All the negative gone. And they can realise emptiness. They'll have the most direct experience of emptiness there. Okay? So they do that. A lot of training. However, interestingly, in death, as we die, naturally, without any effort on our part, these knots start to loosen. They start to loosen. And without any effort on our part, the energy winds start to move in to the central channel. And our mind starts to become clearer and clearer, dropping away all these concepts. The concepts have no purchase. They can't get hold of any. They just go. Just naturally. Now, if you can die with awareness, and if you can, if you have a good, really, I would say a good deity practice, a good tantric practice, then you practice this. And there are special courses and teachings which are very, very detailed. But if you can, one of the reasons of dying with awareness is that you recognize the stages of death. You recognize your mind becoming clearer and clearer. And most importantly, you recognize when the clear light comes. And if you've practiced and if you have the chance, you can stay in that clear light and become enlightened at that stage without having to go into the bardo. There are different opportunities in the deaths, you know, past that. But this is one of the things. So 72, so they say, 72,000 channels within the body. You know, I don't know who counted, but there you go. The three most important, the central channel, thin, made of light, really, blue on the outside, oily red on the inside, coming all the way down in front of the spine, not touching, branching off. You'll see these in the books, you can get covered, to the sexual area, to the back passage. Two side channels, red, white, coming up. These hold different types of negative energy coming down. And for the purposes of this, you could say entering the central channel, four finger widths below the navel. And from this, all the other channels moving out. And it, what's in these channels? Well, energy winds, carrying the mind. Also, if you do Tantra, you'll find out about drops as well, movement of the drops, but that's quite, I won't go into that at the moment. But it has these drops, which are quite important, that we're born with, and these drops move and exit the body at certain times at death. And you can recognise that, and we'll definitely talk about that, come into that. So that's the, when you're dying, what you're trying to be aware of, it's not just what's happening physicality, it's understanding what's happening within the subtle body. And if you can't, keep in your awareness for as long as possible. Always being aware that if it's sudden death, and depending on karma, it can happen like that. You can go through all the stages. I mean, we think we've got this stage, and this stage, and give one, it's nice. You may have that time, but it may also be like that. But if we start learning now, it becomes important, because especially the first three stages of death, you can practice recognising them as you fall asleep, because it's exactly the same. That's just a broad overview, eh? Any questions about that? No. I quite understand. If this is the first or even the, only the 100th time you've heard it, you're going, I'm not asking a question because I can't formulate one, but I'm really confused. It's okay.
Is there any danger in opening the chakras before death? You know, you often see these things that says
yes.
Chakra openings,
yes,
you know.
Yes. Well, I don't really understand. I remember doing some meditations where you were imagining, you were working with the central channel, and it was done in the imagination, and quite a good meditation. It was a simple meditation I was taught years ago about how to wake yourself when you're meditating and you're getting really tired. You know. This particular meditation, excellent for kind of wakening the mind up, and that's using the central channel. Now, I don't think for a moment I opened any central channel, but practicing just woke me up. I was like, oh, Lord, you know, get back to it. However, in the audience was a lady who worked, was a healer, not a lot of healers, working with different chakras. And she came up to me and really berated me. And it took me a while to find out. She was really going on at me, and I'm going, oh, right. So I just waited till she calmed down. And the problem was, she said I hadn't closed the chakras. And I should always close the chakras. I said, right. I had no clue what she was talking about. But I, from her point of view, that was a dangerous thing to do. But it's not, I mean, come on, 30 years, I'm still here. And everybody I know practices these types of methods. Because I was taught it by my teacher, so I'm not fussed. But from her point of view, there was a danger. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, you couldn't get near, from my understanding, is you couldn't get near to opening those chakras unless you were practicing as a yogi.
Right.
But that doesn't stop you practicing.
Mm.
That doesn't stop you rehearsing it. But these take, I mean, the concentration you would need. You know how difficult it is to keep your mind on something without wandering off? Well, to be able to do that, you're going to have single-pointed concentration. You'd have to have shamatha within the Buddhist concept to have that. Which is why it's interesting to know that at the time of death, it happens naturally. through the death process. So another way of accessing this clear light is understanding the death process, recognizing and harnessing it if you can. And your first step on that is learning about it, practicing it, and then as you fall asleep, I think this is, if you can, try to recognize at least the first stage. It gives you confidence. You think, ooh, yeah. So, right, what I'd like you to look at now, just to have a wee brief shuffle. Because you're all going to be dying before lunch, I'm just saying.
It's up to one, you know. I need another bowl.
Now, when we do the death process, please don't worry about making notes. I've got a handout for you, Robert.
Oh, I didn't realise.
So I'd rather you concentrate on the meditation, Jill.
Here, are you sure?
Yes. Oh, thank you. Right. So here's a quite a simple handout. Just take a minute to look at that. Handout is showing really, and this is not the meditation handout I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you one that's much more in depth than that. Not mine, just one that we use with, you know, within the group. Okay. What it shows you is that there are distinct steps, and we go through this as we die, whether we die suddenly, whether we're dying in fear, whether we're dying in any, it doesn't matter how we die, everyone dies, and these stages occur. Whether we recognise them or not, or whether we've got time to access, that's a different thing. So here we're looking at this. We're saying our body is composed of four elements, okay? Earth, water, fire and air. And you could say that the body is also, body-mind is also composed of what's called the four the five skandhas, form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, which is like karma really, and consciousness. You can find this in any book, but basically saying this is a different way of looking at the body, and it's very useful to look at it in this way when you're dying. Because these are the things that start to disappear, that start to weaken. And when form, feeling, compositional factors, all of these things start to weaken, what happens? And the earth element starts to go, or the fire, or the water, or the air, when they start to dissolve and lose their hold and lose their power, because it's in sequence, if you can imagine that the power is going from the earth element, say it's going into the water element, and at that moment the water element becomes more powerful, yes? And then that starts to disappear into the fire element, which suddenly becomes more powerful, yes? And then when that starts to lose its power, it goes into the air element, and that suddenly becomes more powerful. So it's not like it disappears. It loses its power and dissolves down, initially enhancing the next stage of dissolution. And it's good to know that, because with each stage of the dying, there is a physical appearance that outsiders will see. Somebody in the room that's dying, you can notice. There'll be distinct things that you can feel that's happening to you with each stage. On top of that, you will have an internal vision that accompanies this dissolution. And this internal vision is your mind becoming clearer and clearer. Your mind getting, you know, not getting, it's not actively doing it, it's just naturally these concepts just disappearing. Mind becoming clearer, clearer. And if you get to know this sequence, then at the time of death, actually it also helps you in the sleep, but the first bit, but anyway, the time of death, you kind of recognise what's going on. And if you've practiced a little bit, and if you've got time at death, then they say, the fear goes. I mean, you there I am, I'm there, you know? And if you can do that, I've been told that not only does it reduce fear, but it reduces the grasping, because at the time of death there's a what's going on is really a lot of grasping at keeping what you have. And then towards the end of the process, grasping to get out of where you are. And then in the bardo, grasping for a new body. There's a lot of that going on. A lot of grasping. Due to attachment. So if you look at that, you could say that as all these things move, they all sequentially deteriorate and they lose their power. One absorbs into another. The dying person has physical feelings associated with each stage. It has mental visions associated with each stage. And whoever's around you will see some form of physical manifestation. Get to know that. Imagine how that would help you with someone who's dying. That's very important. Okay. So you look at the first bit. Earth element dissolves. Can take up to weeks. It can take even longer. Lamas often, I was told, and certainly, if you understand what the earth element is and how it manifests in the body, sometimes you can see it start to deteriorate weeks before the person dies. And I have to say, with my father, it was very clear. Suddenly, the earth element, it didn't take anything psychic to see the earth element going. I mean, you can see it for weeks up to end. Then, but it can take up to weeks, and lamas often have clairvoyant skills, know when they're going to die, or they recognise the different signs of death. So not just the earth element being reabsorbed, actually losing its power, but there are other signs. If you read the books, you'll find it in the Bardo. There are actually signs that death is close, and they recognise these signs. So they get themselves all ready, and get themselves into position. Okay. So you can see there's an outer appearance here and an inner appearance. So the next thing, water element dissolves. So the earth element is dissolving into the water element. And so there's an outer appearance and there's an inner appearance. Fire element dissolves, an outer appearance and an inner appearance. And certainly as you're falling asleep, you can catch this. The first one, once you practice a little bit, you can usually feel this happening. And when we do the meditation, you'll be able to see what we're talking about here. But you'll actually feel these. Imagine becoming so familiar with that. Amazing. And then the air, wind element dissolves. Then you've got breathing difficulties, and then the breath stops. That's the outer appearance, no heartbeat. And of course, at this stage, people think you're dead. This is the stage, isn't it? There's no breath, there's no heartbeat, you're dead. From many other cultures' idea, this is just not the same. The inner body still has an inner breath and an inner life. Okay? And so this is why at this stage, it's really best that you don't disturb the body, if possible, because there's so much still going on, and we'll talk about that. Then you've got a vision within the person. A white appearance. This is an internal vision here. No breathing, no brain activity. The coarse mind, this, remember we talked about gross, subtle and very subtle? Well, coarse is just another way of saying gross. So this gross mind we're using now, completely shut down, doesn't seem to be any brain activity. And the subtle mind becomes active. Subtle energies start moving. You're visibly dead, but still, you have this inner body, this inner life, the mind is still active. And what comes to the individual's mind is this white light, pervasive light. Then what happens is you have a vision of a red increase. The mind changes to a red increase. The subtle mind withdraws into the central channel. So now we're coming into the central channel. And then the red light appearance, that's why you get that. Because you know that when the red light appearance comes, the winds have entered the central channel. So if you've got the practice, this is the time to be really aware. Okay. Then you've got what's called black near attainment, and the subtle body shuts down, and the subtle mind stops. And they say it's like fainting. There's a sudden blackness, like a faint. That's what you feel if you're dying. It's like a faint, black. And what's happened here is this is the mind of black appearance. The heart chakra opens. And the very subtle mind, do you remember we talked about the very subtle body mind becomes active? This very subtle, which is within the central channel, within the heart chakra. This then leads to the clear light, vision of clear light. And this clear light, clarity, non-conceptuality, the clear light of bliss, actual death, very subtle mind-body, and this is when it leaves the body. And then and only then would a Buddhist say the person has died. And there are some external appearances that sometimes happen. A little bit of blood coming from nostrils, white discharge from the sexual organs. You know, that's a very, the look of the body, the waxen appearance, the smell. That comes very quickly once this happens. If the lamas, and many lamas do, can hold this clear light and they're meditating, they look dead. Everybody says they're dead, but they're still sitting up or lying on their side and they're meditating. And the body is still warm to the touch, more or less. It's not waxing, there's no smell, there's no discharge anywhere. And then, after a while, when they've finished, the body slumps. And then all the signs of death appear. The high lamas do that. And in India, certainly, when this happens, Alan was saying they often invite the populace to come and view what's going on. You know, not touching the body, not interfering, but seeing what's happening. It's happened quite a few times. Let people see so they know what's possible. So these are the stages. Same for everybody. Same for anybody.
Does this have a simple... is there a time frame? Or is it...
No.
The time frame is different.
No,
for
different, yeah. Like I say, it could be that... literally that fast. Or it could be very long drawn out. Especially this first one, the earth element. Very handy, I think. If you've got a chronic or long-term illness and you start to notice certain things, you know... Start to get ready.
So if you die suddenly, then all this will happen very quickly.
Very quickly.
All of it will happen.
All of it. All of it.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. These stages don't change. Mm-hmm. These are exactly the same stages.
So we're saying it becomes very hard or impossible to catch it. Then.
Oh yes.
Does your I'm just thinking about in the West when they kind of get rid of the body very quickly. But then the tradition in Buddhism where they leave the body for a while.
Yeah.
Is that because the mind doesn't actually leave the body until it reaches
yes.
the clear light?
Yes.
So is there a danger in the West here, if we were in hospital,
yes.
that they get rid of the body before you've actually left
yes.
it? So that's pretty serious then.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, of course. Touching the body in this stage... Thing is, the body and mind are closely linked. They're not the same, but they're closely linked. And touch, when people are in this stage, if you touch different parts of the body, the mind is drawn to that part. And it's said that the mind can leave through lower orifices. Okay? But that tends to be towards the lower realms, really, of existence. And if you've got that type of karma, then... touching the body in the wrong place is not helpful because it draws the mind that way. If you have to touch the body or you have to move the body, you've no choice. Then it's good to touch the crown of the head, right, before anything else happens. And your hope, you're praying, I mean, we'll talk about this, but always have a stupa here, touching the crown of the head, and that'll help draw the energy up. So leaving through the orifices at the top of the body, they say, is far more going towards the higher realms. Mm. It's true, in hospitals, very difficult. very difficult. And they get very annoyed.
How long should you leave the body?
I'm sorry?
Ideally.
They say about 3 days.
2 days.
Three. Having said that, for non-practitioners, it might be less than that. Really. Mostly, the more you practice Dharma, the more important I think it is to do that. Non-practitioners of Dharma, they may go through these stages, they may recognise and do something with them, but if you don't know, how would you do that? But just to be absolutely safe, as long as possible.
So, sorry for asking, but when your parents died, did you want their body to be left alone for a few days, or were you more going with what they're...
Okay, so my father died before I could get to him, so he'd already been... it was very sudden. Mm-hmm. I was with my mother when she had a stroke, mm-hmm. and so we went to hospital. And it was difficult because I was dealing with my sister, who wanted to headbutt the doctor. Because the doctor came to see us, it was a massive stroke. And the doctor was saying, really, there's nothing they could do. And did we understand that? And would they understand if they didn't do anything too active because it was too big?
Yeah.
Of course, my sister heard, I'm not going to treat your mother, she's too old. That's what she heard.
Right.
And I had to hold her back. Really, that doctor was frightened, and he had every right to be. Fiona was very angry. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was kind of feeling that. So I did say to the staff I wanted my mother left alone, but you could see it was like 11 o'clock at night. They were quite busy with what they were doing. We had a room on our own. The doctors were in a changeover. You know, it was all this going on. So the doctor examined my mother, and he said, I'll come back every hour to examine her. I said, why? And he said, what do you mean? I said, why? Why would you do that? You're not going to treat her. Mm-hmm. You're not going to treat her. So all you'll be doing is touching, listening, and recording what, how she's dying. He said, yes. I said, no. Mm-hmm. So the family's wishes are now, if you're not going to treat her, please don't come back. I mean, not being nasty, but I'd rather you didn't and left us alone. Mm-hmm. So actually, now in hospitals, they're much... listen to families much more now than they used to. And I have to say that when you're old, they don't care that much. I mean, they don't. Mm. I mean, it's not that they're uncaring, but they won't do anything too active. So they're quite happy for you to be there and then get on with their work, usually. And so I was with my mum, my sister and I were with my mum for, a long time. And she died about 1:30 in the morning. And I had already spoken to Fiona about what to do and what not to do, keeping it calm, doing prayers. I mean, we're doing that. I'm on the phone to Wendy saying, could you do this, that, and the next thing? I'm doing the prayers and doing whatever and helping Fiona. And this was keeping it calm, keeping it clear. And I never told the doctors. And I stayed there until it was clear she had died. And basically we just didn't do it. We kept, just stayed with my mother until the changeover of shift. Mm-hmm. So this doctor came back and he was furious. He was absolutely furious. Young guy. You should have... He came and said, your mum's dead. I said, no kidding. You know. And I was so upset. I mean, I was really upset. Because when I get upset, I get even more Scottish, eh? Not a good thing. Not a good thing. I'm going, you're kidding. Really? And Fiona's going, it's okay, mate. So she's now calming me down. And he says, you should have told me. I said, why? You wouldn't do anything. Yes, but we should record it. I said, she died at 1:30. 1:30? It's 8:30. I said, I know.
So it's hard, yeah.
He was very, very annoyed. Mm. Didn't bother me one thing. I've dealt with the annoyed doctors all my life. They didn't bother me. So I told him to leave. I didn't want that type of atmosphere in the room. He was livid. The nurses were fine. Nurses were great. They came in and did what they had to do. God gave us. But sometimes you have to fight for this, eh?
If you can
let them know beforehand, it's helpful. But it's not guaranteed they'll do it.
No. But also, you obviously had some. I mean, you're a nun, and your sister respects the fact that you're a Buddhist. And in my family, everyone just go, "Oh God, Arabelle's being all weird again." If I said, "Don't move, Mum." they just wouldn't have it. They wouldn't hear it.
Yeah.
So I probably wouldn't want to interfere because...
It's your mum.
Well, if my brother and sister were there, for example, and my father...
Well, all you can do is ask. But I tell you, you would be surprised. I've been at a lot of deathbeds with different types of people, with different types of... You'd be surprised. People don't know what to do.
Right.
And if you say something like, you know, in my belief, in my understanding, here's what would be helpful. Would you join me in this? You would be amazed. I've had people from all different religions stand at the foot of the bed reading the King of Prayers. Now, I don't know if you've ever read the King of Prayers, but it's very Buddhist. It's very tantric. Without a blink, they're doing it. Without a blink. No, no joking. And that's not me or whatever. It's just sometimes people appreciate a wee bit of direction if it's gently meant.
Right.
So don't assume that's going to happen.
Okay.
Don't assume it. Just with gentleness say, there's nothing you can do for Mum now, but in, you know, from my faith, there are things I can do. Would you help me do these prayers?
Yeah, yeah.
And you will be really surprised how many people will be so happy you do that. Really?
Yeah.
But if your mother is Christian and there's a priest or a vicar around, and hospital vicars, I mean, I got when Mum was still semi-conscious, about 12, the hospital... Catholic priest came and did the last rites, and Mum, you could see Mum was responding, and it was beautiful, the last rites, and Mum being Catholic really appreciated that. The thing to do is not go in with all Buddhist guns flaring.
Yeah.
Can I ask
something? Yes.
If two things really. If someone has died and you're in a place that tends to ring the police and do things as quickly as possible,
which they expect you to do.
Yeah, somebody has to do that.
Yeah.
If you do the touching the crown, is that a good thing to do?
I think if the body has to be moved, and you've no control over that, then yes. Doing the particular prayers, and if you've got a stupa, that's very good. If you've got, I always carry one in my car, touching the crown of the head with a blessed stupa, very good. And it helps to draw the consciousness.
Yeah. The other thing is people going in and out of consciousness.
Yes.
Where they seem to come back sort of less there, do you know?
The mind can become quite clear. If you've ever been with people who are dying,
gradually, I mean, when I say less, they come back.
Yes.
And sometimes it's almost more lucid. It's
yes,
like they can
I've noticed
very
that.
Very seriously confused,
yes.
And then just.
But this is what I'm saying: as you die, the mind becomes clearer and clearer. These concepts go, and sometimes people are so. I mean, I've worked in intensive care, cardiothoracics, and the rest, and hospices. And sometimes when people rally, it's called a rally. You know, they rally, and sometimes they're more lucid and clearer than they've been for years.
Yeah.
And the family are so surprised, but you won't be surprised. Because you know what's going on.
And they're still dying, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
Because people are saying, they've come back to us, you know, but actually they've sort of...
Yeah. You see, this is why it's important, the meditations we did earlier, when you're tracing back continuity of mind. This is why I did all this impermanence, continuity, what is the nature of mind? One moment of mind giving rise to the next. Do you remember the one where we went back in time, the rest of the day, then weeks and months and years, as far back as you can go, wondering where it started? And if it actually had a start, if one moment of mind gives rise to the next. And then we went forward to the time of death. Now, if you understand this, you can see the mind is still active. The gross mind gives way to the subtle mind. The subtle mind gives way to the very, very subtle mind. And that's released. Now that's taking that meditation even further. So you can do this meditation and add on what you're learning now. Yes.
So can I just clear up a couple of points in your answer to something? If somebody dies at home, can you leave them there for 3 days? You're not allowed to. You have to report it.
You have to report it.
You can.
Personally?
Mm. You can leave it.
Yes.
But after you've reported it.
Yeah, you report it. Yeah.
You have to report it.
Then if you ask the, what's it called, Mary Tips Coffin Wing, Body Wing.
Undertaker.
Well, if he's a nice one, you'll just see it.
They're all nice. They all want your money. They'll do exactly what you've asked them. No, really?
Yeah, so you
it's a very competitive business.
Yes.
Very competitive.
So the doctor doesn't intervene and say, get this body to the morgue or
anything? Many doctors will. Absolutely.
So it's best just
and many of them, I mean, they'll send an ambulance, and once you get the ambulance team there, oh dear. Lots of things happen. So you have to make a decision. You have to make a decision. And then take the consequences. That's it. You need to know people, eh? You need to know people. Get to know your GP. Work out who your undertaker is going to be. Make sure that they know. But at the time, if you're there and this person is absolutely dead, I mean, you know. I mean, it's very hard to not know. Right? Usually an expected death it is. And there is nothing else to be done. Personally, I wouldn't be informing anybody straight away.
No.
I'd be doing my practices.
Yeah.
And when I finished my practice and I thought that was okay, then I'd phone. Yeah. If I thought it wasn't okay and that person still looked to be fairly active internally, not that I would know that well, but I'd get a clue, I wouldn't tell anybody.
Yeah,
it's like that doctor. He was so annoyed with me.
Yeah.
And he said, I will report. I said, please do. I mean, please.
You can always sort of say, oh, I was so overcome with grief that I didn't even think about it for
no,
three
I wouldn't,
days.
No, I wouldn't even lie. I wouldn't even lie. No.
Well, that would be quite true.
No, don't. Don't give any excuse. Just do it. Mm. And then if there's consequences, be happy with it.
Well, it was just more the sort of legal thing, you know. I just thought, can they tell when the body died, and then if there was a 3-hour gap, they might think you murdered them or something. I just...
I mean, these are scenarios that from CSIA. Normally, that nothing like that happens.
Right.
Nothing like that happens. And people know that in grief and in time of extremis, time goes at a different rate. You know. I mean, a friend of mine had her husband didn't want her husband. She wasn't a Buddhist. She didn't want her husband to. He had a tumor. And he was dying, she took him home. She didn't tell anybody for 2 days when he died. She laid on the bed with him for the first few hours and then prepared the body the way she wanted. I mean, she was Christian, she wasn't kind of thing. And then she told them. And a few people were quite upset, why didn't you know? She didn't want to. Nothing came of it.
Right.
But even if it did, so what?
Well, I was just wondering, you know, what the consequences were. That's all, you know, because otherwise one worries. Like, you would go to prison or something. You know?
I don't think you'd go to prison. You won't go to prison. I mean, that's the realm of fantasy, really. I mean, it's usually... I mean, if it's a sudden death, and it's someone you know, I mean, you can't... You just have to make a decision at that time. Is it reasonable for you to behave in that way? If it's more reasonable that they're dying and something could be done, then you have to pull out all the stops. Life is precious. You know, you don't make these type of decisions arbitrarily. You have to kind of be... But in my mind, it's like... I call it taking the hit. Sometimes you do stuff. Not a lot of times, but sometimes you do stuff knowing there's going to be consequences. You just take the hit.
Yeah.
But your choice.
Okay. In your experience, are hospices more sort of amenable to leaving a body?
Certainly. All the ones I've ever worked in.
Right,
yes.
Okay. So you'd be better if say, it was a terminal illness to go down that route.
If you could get into a hospice, they're very rare now.
And do you have to pay to go into a hospice? No.
Well, it depends. There are private hospices, but there are hospices attached to the NHS, but they're really, really few and far between now.
Right. Yeah.
And often, there's actually a waiting list for people who are dying to get into them, because often hospices now are not... You go in and you get your symptoms treated. See, because what causes a lot of pain and difficulty at the time of death is not so much the illness, but the symptoms.
Oh.
Things like nausea, pain, even restless leg syndrome. There's things that really just you can't, and hospices will deal with that. They've got good pharmacists on site, and then they'll send you back home. And then you might go in for a bit of respite. So once you get a connection with the hospice, if there is the space, you can go. But these spaces, when I was working at the Marsden in London, I was went to quite a few of the hospices there. Most of them don't exist anymore, even the most famous ones. There are a few around, but look at this wide area here.
Yeah.
How many hospices do you know? Very few.
Just hospice at home.
Two hospice at home. Just hospice at home.
But that's what they're calling it, hospice at home. And it sounds nice, but it's only words. It means that a nurse will come and see you. Really, it's words. I mean, I'm sorry. It really is. It's good. They're dedicated people. They're helpful. But it's words. It's hospice at home. What are you getting? You're getting a nurse, usually, if you're lucky, that knows about death and dying, but coming to visit you. Why they call it a hospice, I don't know. If you've ever worked in a hospice, that's a whole different kettle of fish. That's all geared to the person that's dying. That's an area that where death is not a failure. Death is the death becomes the last gift that you can give someone to be able to die the way they want to. It becomes a gift. Hard to do that with hospice at home. The resources aren't there. This is why, you know, Buddhist retreats like this place and other places throughout the world, on their wish list is to have a hospice. I mean, that's their wish. I mean, here and all over the world, Buddhists would like to die in a Buddhist hospice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't? But you'd be lucky to be able to die in a hospice, any hospice, let alone a Buddhist one. All over the world, Buddhists are saying, I wish we could do this. It's true. They do wish it. The chances are very, very rare. But people are trying very hard. And in Australia, isn't it, they've got a Buddhist hospice at home group that they go out to people.
Yeah, they do.
They do, and seemingly that works very well. But it's not, honestly, if you've ever worked in a hospital, it is not the same. It isn't the same.
Well, it assumes as well, if it's hospice in a home, that the family are having to look after the terminally ill or friends.
Yeah. If your family are still alive. If your friends are still alive.
Yeah, exactly.
They do have more hospices available as well, though, in Australia. Yeah. But seemingly, yeah. Just for, for the Christians and Catholics.
We're having a little chat here, but we are kind of concentrating on the death. What I'm thinking is maybe you have a chat for another 5 minutes and then we'll have an early break, because I don't want to do this meditation short. I want you to do it in depth, and I want you to get a real feeling for it. So maybe we'll do this after the break. So,
I just have to come back to the sudden death question again. Because are there prayers that you can... are there Buddhist prayers that are specifically designed to help people who have sudden death?
I think all the prayers and mantras deal with death at any stage for me. I don't know if there's... I'd have to check. I'm so wedded to the prayers that I use. They're just so powerful that I don't see there would be any difference. But we can check. I know there's different prayers for carers, which is a really good one to have.
Yeah.
For carers, very helpful. And carers can do this whether they're Buddhist or not. Really. But we'll check that. It's just once you know a few of the really powerful ones, you really don't want to use anything else because they're just too useful and too helpful.
I think it's a case of for the people left behind when somebody's snatched away in sudden death, to be able to say something to help them seemingly through the bardo state or whatever.
Yes, there's certain lamas that are trained in this, and certainly in Tibet, the lama would come, and that was their big night, really. I mean, lamas didn't tend to do a lot of teaching as such. It was more ceremonies and rituals for people who were ill, divinations. But death is their big stage. That's the time when they flourish, the lamas, the village lamas. And they could sit by the body for all night and more, literally whispering into the ear and directly connecting with the mind and guiding them through the bardo. And some lamas are very, very good at this. Very good at this. And some lamas are extremely good at poa, the transference of consciousness. There's a lama at Kopan that's very famed for this, but there's a few. If they've trained in this, so many, I mean, we have poa prayers and poa sadhanas, etc., but there are certain lamas that are really good at transferring consciousness. So what we're talking about here is being with the individual and at the right point, because if you don't do it at the right point, you're actually killing the person. Okay? So at the right point, they have the ability to transfer that consciousness from that body into a pure land. It's called poa. Poa. And we certainly do poa prayers for deceased. And there's poor meditations we can do, but not everybody's got that type of skill, but it does help. It does help. But if you've got lamas that are really good at that, then they can do the transference of consciousness. And some lamas are so good, they can do it from a distance. But I was talking to a very highly trained Kargyu Lama in Wales, and he's got some reputation for poa. And he said, I'm very lucky that I have that karma that I can do this, he said, but even I have to be very close to the person.
Physically
yes. Mm-hmm. He said other people he considers his masters can do it from a distance. I mean, there's poor prayers to do from a distance. This is not, you do your best. But there's some people who've got that particular skill. Okay? Anything else before the break? Before we die. Great. Okay, so please have a break. It's 4:15, so if you come back, say, in 20 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Remembering the silence until
Can I just ask?
Of course, of course.
This is all just.
Thank you. Sorry. You're very kind.
This is just rudimentary stuff. But,
no.
So, is a hospice the same as palliative care?
Well,